Hey everyone, welcome to the Next Year Migos podcast. Tom and I are with Betsy Plimack, and we are going to talk about toxicity management around IO-based doublets and kidney cancer. We're not going to talk so much about efficacy, but kind of the practical nuts and bolts of tox management now as these are sort of rolling out into practice. So Betsy, thanks for joining us. Maybe introduce yourself and you can sort of give us a little bit of your sort of take on tox management for these doublets broadly.
Sure. So I'm Betsy Plimack. I'm at Fox Chase Cancer Center in Philadelphia. Tom and Brian, thanks for having me. This is a topic the three of us chat about pretty regularly on email and otherwise. And so it's nice to be able to kind of explore it together. So, you know, the VEGF IO doublets are firmly in the frontline setting. I think for renal cell, there's probably a role for pure IO therapy. There's probably a role for observation and for single agent VEGF. But given the efficacy we've seen pretty consistently across multiple phase three trials, I would, you know, say most patients probably are and should be getting IO VEGF combinations in the front line. So, you know, one of the things we've been talking about a lot lately is picking the most efficacious regimen to then manage for toxicity, right? Once you start a patient on a regimen, it's really important to try to keep it manageable for them because they'll be on it long term because these drugs work. But also to be able to kind of keep the dose at the sweet spot, right, where you're getting efficacy without too much grind in terms of toxicity. And the dose that we modulate, of course, is the VEGF, right, not the IO. That's the standard.
So talk about how you do that. I mean, I guess maybe talk first about are there patients who you think just won't tolerate a doublet and do you kind of start them on one and later on the other as the first step?
So sometimes I do. I try, you know, since the side effects are pretty random, I don't know if you agree, but, you know, I usually say, here's the long list of side effects you could get with VEGF. Here are all the things that could go wrong with immunotherapy. You're not going to get all of them. We hope you get very few of them, but let us know what you get, and then we'll react to it. So it's very much in the first month or so, especially with the VEGF, a trial and error. So the way I manage it is I try to be aggressive and pick doublets, you know, give doublets, except for the very good risk patient I've been observing for years where we're just getting started, they're worried about toxicity, there I might start with a VEGF and then layer in the IO. But for the most part, I do start with a doublet. How about you guys?
How about, are there patients, for me, yes, I agree, for the vast majority, but some patients are so sick. You know, I've had patients who are just really sick, you know, who just by the time they get to my office, you know, are PS 2, 3, et cetera.
Right.
That I was worried about the doublet and I've started them on IO monotherapy and then layered in VEGF. It's pretty rare. I can think of maybe two or three patients in the last few years. But
I would say generally don't do that. I think if the patient's sick from disease, I go for it. Feel like I have one shot. And if the patient's sick from other things, then that's sort of a different conversation where.
Yeah.
So I agree. It's a rare situation. And this is where the art of oncology comes in, right? You have the patient in front of you and you know what your drugs are capable of, both efficacy and tox-wise and sort of what they can handle or what you risk. But I think generally, you know, if patients are starting with both, the issue that comes up is when tox happens, how do you attribute it?
Right.
And then how do you manage it? And always in your mind, you're looking to attribute it and then, you know, both those things sort of in parallel.
So how often do you see people on these doublet regimens, you or your nurse practitioner or some provider?
Right. So we always see them. I mean, it depends on the infusion, like which IO you're giving and how often the infusion schedule is. So I certainly see them each infusion. With Axi-Pembro, for instance, you know, we do give the 3-week Pembro at least to start because we don't really have data for the 6-week, although we have flexed on that for patients on it long-term. So I'm seeing them every 3 weeks. And especially when starting anyone in a VEGF, my practice has always been to see them at week 3 or 4, again, to identify quickly what they're experiencing and be able to intervene quickly before like the hand foot gets to blisters or before the diarrhea gets to be the point where they want to throw their drug in the garbage. You know?
Betsy, when you let the patients go home for the first time, what do you tell them about contacting the support team? Do you want information? When are you saying, listen, you need to get back on the phone if what is happening and how often do they comply with that?
Yeah, so we're really regimented about that. We've really mapped out. We have a care plan. We give it to them in writing. We have a sheet with phone numbers. We have a wallet card for them to put in their wallet. So, and we do teaching both on our end and then, you know, our RN comes in and does more. Then we have a system where the nurse calls them, right? Just whether or not they call, they get a phone call saying, how are you doing on your therapy? So, I mean, I hope we emphasize this enough. Sometimes patients, you know, occasionally they'll come to their appointment like in a puddle and you're like, why didn't you call me? I could have helped. But for the most part, they do call.
When does your nurse call?
You know, they have a specific regimen. I think during the first week they're called.
Okay.
And that's actually a pharmacist. Sort of around the oral medications. The infusion oral medications, patients are seen so often, and the IO, I think, it's sort of a constant vigilance you need to sort of impart on the patient. But in the first few weeks, it's important.
We've talked pretty much exclusively about VEGF-TKI immune combinations. Let's keep going with that. So when patients are coming in with these drugs, when can they expect to get their sort of maximum toxicity? When does the toxicity start to occur? And we know that there's a lot of variability, particularly with immune-related toxicity, but we are seeing fatigue, we are seeing stomatitis, we are seeing diarrhea, and obviously hand and foot syndrome with these drugs. Are they happening at the same time with the VEGF-targeted therapy and the same severity, or do you see it as being slightly different?
So I think that is a clue to attribution that you just mentioned, is the time frame. So I tell patients, whatever you're going to experience with VEGF, we're going to see a hint of it in the first month, usually, right? And I think sort of for VEGF supports that, as does all the other side effects that you just mentioned, Tom, right? So if something happens at month six, like acute diarrhea, I think that really, because why would you get that all of a sudden from your VEGF that you haven't had diarrhea from before? So I think time frame is really important when you're thinking about attribution, and that parlays into management, right? The patient who gets profuse diarrhea at month six, you would be much more have a heightened concern for immune-mediated colitis and start steroids potentially earlier. Although I would argue for, you know, again, the move with VEGF-IO to attribute and manage toxicity. If you have the luxury of waiting a few days, wait a few days and see what happens. And then, of course, the half-lives of the VEGF we're talking about today are variable, so that plays in.
Right.
But usually, if something gets better with just holding, it's probably the TKI. Do you guys
agree. That? I think some of the challenge in a community setting is it takes a fair amount of effort because you have to assess the patient, you have to get LFTs or whatever in 3 days, or assess them again in 3 days, you know, on a provider staff, on a nursing staff. I think it's certainly more
it's
intense as opposed to just starting them on steroids, right? That's sort of the easier answer, but I totally agree with you.
So Brian,
although I would argue that in the long term, since these drugs work, the efforts at the, it's front loaded, right? Like if you put in that effort at the beginning, it's something that is going to prevent sort of further episodes down the road. And I think all three of us have patients cruising now on whatever dose that they're on. That then I think pays back later.
I agree. And I would emphasize, and I emphasize this to patients. I say, listen, give me a couple months to sort of figure out how to dose you. You know, how are you going to tolerate? There's an adjustment period for me and the patient in the first 6 to 8 weeks. And if we can get through that, then patients tend to cruise. I agree.
Right. That's really important, Brian, because you're really saying it's not going to be like this forever. This is the start. We're in it with you, right? There's a lot of things that I love that sort of setup.
Well, and we give everybody the same dose. Guess what? It's not going to be the right dose for everybody.
Exactly right.
So we talked about this exploratory journey at the beginning. Let's say hypothetically, and let's not specify which regime to start with, that the individual phones your nurse or our nurse at week four, having just started the second infusion, saying that I suddenly got diarrhea. It's happening 4 or 5 times a day. I'm losing control of it. My hands are a bit sore. What advice should that patient receive that's phoned up asking for that?
Come in. We need to see you.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think hold the drug. Don't take your drug today. And that sort of does a couple things. One, you're doing your hold, you know, your sort of hold intervention, which is diagnostic and potentially therapeutic. And two, you're really emphasizing the partnership around management of this. Again, in that early period, where, as Brian says, you want to get it right.
And let's say that patient comes in and they hold the drug, and after 4 or 5 days, they've still got diarrhea 4 times a day. What and liver function, you know, there's a grade one transaminitis. What are you doing with that patient? Are you starting steroids, and how long are you prepared to just stop the drug? Let's start with cabo or lenvatinib, because their half-life is a little bit longer.
I think it depends a little bit on how sick the patient looks. I mean, if I'm getting to day 4 and 5, even with cabo or lenva, I'm starting to worry about immune-mediated toxicity more than TKI. And plus, the way you presented the case was sort of sudden onset, which is generally not how TKIs, you know, come out in terms of diarrhea. So I'd have a lower threshold of steroids in that patient, or at least getting them in and evaluating them. I'd be a little worried.
Do you do that inpatient, or do you give patients oral steroids? How do you do that?
Depends how sick they look. I try to keep them out. You know, it depends on, you know, if it's an 82-year-old, you know, with other medical problems and limited reserve, et cetera, and it's Friday afternoon, I'm just admitting that patient. Right?
Yeah,
just,
right.
You know, if it's a 52-year-old with good support system and et cetera, and they're close to the medical center, then I'm going to try to manage them as an outpatient. So I think that's just the variability.
Well, let's see,
have you found any? Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Tom.
No, Betsy, you go. I apologize.
I was going to say, have either of you found any issues with absorption of oral steroids with the GI toxicities like diarrhea, where IV actually works better?
I'm sure. I can't think of specific cases necessarily, but there've definitely been people we've started on oral steroids who've not gotten better, and then
until you
convert them
to IV.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think, I wouldn't say that's
a big
problem.
I think it's important to keep in mind that if the steroids aren't working, if they're oral, to try the IV route. Because some colitis in my experience, but little pearl.
What do you do about, I've come into this in the last couple of weeks, sort of steroid dosing. So not even just diarrhea, but rash or LFTs or whatever. I don't like to give everybody a milligram per kilogram or 60 of prednisone. I don't like to start everybody. And so sometimes I'll sort of finesse it and say, well,
sure,
let's try 40. Let's try 20 for a few days and see what happens. I mean, do you do that? Or?
I do. I mean, the 1 mg/kg, you know, if you have someone who's really large, I had someone the other day with colitis and ended up being like 150 milligrams of prednisone.
That's a lot.
And, I was always taught like there is like the curve of efficacy flattens out for the oral steroids, right? So above 60 or 80, you're probably not getting that much of an advantage. You're only getting toxicity. So I tend to not try really hard not to go above 60 in general. But I do tend to not, I mean, if I'm going to start, I usually start at 60, Brian, and range of the taper quickly. The bottom range of the taper, I have been burned. I go really slow under 20 milligrams.
I agree.
So like super slow.
Let's move to this individual. Let's say on day 4 now, he's obviously off both drugs because he's not having another infusion. And things settle on day 4. The transaminitis sort of settles a bit. Or let's say day 4. And then he comes back to see you on day 7 and said, actually, I've been going pretty well now for 3 days. No problems, thank you.
Did we give him steroids? I forgot.
Yes, we did. So he's on 60 milligrams of pred. To restart the VEGF TKI if possible. And he's currently on pred 60, and in fact he's relatively asymptomatic, let's call grade one fatigue. What are you saying to this patient now who wants to get back on his treatment dose of his drug? He's on 60 milligrams of pred and he's been 3 days symptom free.
I usually give it longer unless the disease is pressuring me otherwise. Brian, I don't know what you do.
Would keep him off the TKI. I'd be tempted to restart. Because we're saying it's probably immune mediated given the response to steroids and the time course. I'd probably drop him to 40 of pred and restart his TKI. Although I think the thing to remember, there's not an urgency to restart the TKI, you know? I mean, assuming, unless the disease is pressuring, right? Unless it's high volume symptomatic disease.
My take on it is while they're on steroids, my preference is not to restart. Drug, because inevitably the VEGF TKI, the immune drug is still kicking around in the background. I think there probably is some synergistic interaction between some of the adverse events. I don't believe the adverse events are either VEGF or not all of the adverse events. I think hypertension is an exception.
Yeah.
But the transaminitis, for example, has a component. I suspect the transaminitis generated by VEGF-TKI has an immune component to it, even as a single agent. And therefore, the principle of saying, well, it's either... And actually, when we did the trials, it was frustrating because we had to say, is it VEGF or is it immune-related? And if it was immune-related, we had to treat differently from VEGF-related, where I think a lot of the adverse events actually overlap to some extent, diarrhea and transaminitis being the commonest two of those. And so my temptation is actually to keep the patients off active therapy until, you know, until they're a couple of, at least a week or two, you know, on you know, stable. And Betsy, that's right. Earlier is that my temptation is to always give steroids that little bit longer rather than that little bit shorter. But doctors taught me, I think it was Dave McDermott, or it might have been James Larkin, who said, if you're giving steroids, give an extra week and it'll always help you. So I kind of tend
especially at the lower end, right? It's the taper to 8 milligrams, 4 milligrams to off where I find the flares tend to happen.
Right.
And at that low dose, it's lower, you know, you're usually restarting whatever therapy, it's a little bit lower.
So how do you decide when when to restart TKI?
I think if someone's been really good for a while, and especially if their disease is pressuring me to, I restart it. I will say, you know, in some of these patients, we get CRs, right? We get deep responses less than 80%, you know, down to 80%. If I have a patient in that category who hits tox, I sometimes take it as an opportunity to see if they need more therapy, right? Like maybe you can, you know, be in that treatment-free survival. If we've got any discharge response. So that's a very individualized decision, but.
I was going to say, it usually happens early on. So somebody in month 2 or 4, maybe they're responding, you know, so they're not out on the tail of the curve.
Yeah, then we don't know. Right.
Right. So how do you decide when to restart TKI? I think one important point is you should restart TKI. I think we would all agree that just dropping it is a mistake. So how do you decide when to restart? Is it X amount of time on steroids? Is it X amount of time clinically symptom-free or?
I think both those things. I think down below 40 or ideally even down to 20. But if that's taking too long, I restart. After about a month off, I get itchy to restart. So
itchy.
Yeah, nope. I agree. So a successful taper, asymptomatic. I think those two issues are important.
Asymptomatic for how long?
I'd like to be asymptomatic for a couple of weeks. I'd like things to have settled down for a couple of weeks. Yeah. And but there does come a time with a grade 1 transaminitis or, you know, or occasional diarrhea where, as Betsy said, sometimes you just need to get back in and see what happens.
And remember with the VEGF TKIs in the package insert, you can hit liver tox, pause, let it get better and safely restart, right? This is a paradigm we are used to. And so having that confidence, I think, is important. So to that end, yeah, they do have to get.
My next really important question, because this is a concern of mine, is if we are stopping the drugs, what proportion of drugs that you interrupt, what proportion of patients who you interrupt their drugs, can you get back on to some form of therapy or combination therapy?
Get back on both drugs?
Yes. So this patient here,
I think it's the vast majority.
Yeah.
Okay. Yep.
Betsy, do you agree, Betsy?
Yeah. Sorry, I dropped out for a second. Yeah, I think the vast majority do end up definitely back on the VEGF TKI for IO if it's severe, requiring IV steroids. I tend to not restart. I know some colleagues do, but I tend to go on the paradigm that look, they hit tox, they've gotten the maximum benefit, we can afford to have them be off therapy. And I restart the VEGF and then continue. That's usually
So do you ever restart the IO in that circumstance? Or does it depend on severity of tox?
I've done it, but I have to really see. I usually wait till some progression to make sure they need it, to be honest. Yeah, if it's a bad toxicity. Yeah.
It sounds like I tend to restart VEGF sooner and restart IO more.
Yeah,
it sounds that way. Yeah.
So I suspect I'm slightly more cautious in terms of the time to restarting, but I agree, Brian. I try and even for those individuals who've required IV steroids, it wouldn't be unusual for me to have potentially another go. But if we were going to do that, I would keep really close observation under those circumstances. We did learn a little bit. I know it's very different. We did learn a bit from the VEGF TKI era
where when we got even grade three toxicity, sometimes we could re-challenge with the drugs successfully. Mm-hmm. And that good example of that was transaminitis, where often it was worse during the first 12 weeks of their therapy,
right,
and then settled down. But I think it's, you know, that's obviously not for the faint-hearted. And I think you need to be keeping a very close eye on patients that have clearly come into harm's way to do that right. A second time is something that needs careful consideration.
But remember, Tom, in the 426 liver toxicity manuscript that just came out, you know, the majority of people who were rechallenged did just fine.
Right.
So I think that's important data. You know, that took forever to get out in manuscript form. But I think it's important to realize that most people will do just fine with rechallenge. And I think the other piece here is the context of, are you in the first 2 to 3 months or are you out at month 18 and the patient mm-hmm. has a 70% response and they're doing well? Those are, to me, different conversations. Like if I'm farther out, then I'm like you, Betsy, well, let's see if I can get away with no therapy mm-hmm. because the patient's disease is under control. They've had an immune response. You know, I'm feeling much more comfortable than on, mm-hmm. you know, week six where, you know, it's kind of on and we need to, I'm a believer, we need to get as much therapy into patients as possible.
Right. And I think what you're bringing up, Brian, is that the type of toxicity matters, like pneumonitis yeah. versus hepatitis yeah. versus colitis, right? The time frame matters and the urgency that the disease is putting pressure on us matters, right? So there is an art to it. It's nice to be able to put some pearls out there for management, but you know, it's a difficult and tricky scenario to manage.
We've got a couple of minutes, and before we finish, I'd just like you to ask, when are you definitely diving in with IV steroids admitting, and which patients are getting infliximab?
I mean, I can go. It's all about how clinically sick they look, right? We've all been doing this a long time and sat in front of people. You're just like, this patient doesn't look right. They look toxic, right? Those people are definitely getting admitted for IV steroids and or, you know, older patients with less reserve, right? Less organ reserve, where I'm worried that a little bit of dehydration is going to tip them off into something, you know? So those are the people that I would give, that I would lower my threshold for IV steroids. I don't think it's wrong to give them. And we can also just give a dose as an outpatient in the clinic, you know, mm-hmm. give two or three doses as an outpatient if they're close and can come back and just save them the hospital admission. And then right. infliximab I haven't used in a while, maybe because I'm giving less ipi-nivo now and more IOTKI. Mm-hmm. But I haven't used it in a while, but obviously for steroid refractory.
Right. I mean, I would say I tend to admit pneumonitis and colitis pretty certainly if they look sick, but sometimes even if they don't. First of all, I like to get the diagnostics done quickly. So colonoscopy yeah. or if it's big with biopsy, especially if it impacts like our future treatment decisions for the patient. And colitis, we do battle with that sometimes now. Our team tends to like that. There's some data on that. But it's important. Infliximab is not the drug of choice for hepatitis, right? Elevated LFTs, that's more CellCept that we lean on for that. Yeah. And so there is nuance to sort of what immune modulators beyond steroids we use. And that's where, you know, at least talking to a specialized center, I think is critical in those scenarios.
Can I ask both of you, maybe my final question is, I do a whole lot, especially as patients get beyond month two or three of telling them to take little holidays from their TKI, mm-hmm. 3 days, 4 days, 5 days. You know, again, mm-hmm. we have disease control at that point. We've managed toxicity. We're kind of settled in. And mm-hmm. I find it just really recharges the batteries. And you often have to talk patients into it, right? They yeah. don't want to stop a drug that's helping yeah. them. But then they come back and they say, gee, I took 3 days off and I felt great for the next, you know, 2 to 3 weeks. Yeah. Do
yeah,
you guys do that?
Really important thing, for sure. Usually I follow. This is, again, these drugs work, so they're on them for a long time, right? So you got to make it, you know, just like we all need vacation. They need drug holidays to really maintain momentum, right? So I agree.
And Betsy, anything specific for afatinib or axitinib? More similarities than differences between the drug? Any specific advice for any one of those drugs?
Well, I think I can speak more theoretically. Obviously, I've given a lot of axi pembro and less of the other two, but the longer half-life of lenvatinib and cabozantinib has to be taken into account when you do the hold and see if it resolves yep. trick.
Yeah.
It's easier. Dosing of lenvatinib and cabo is clunkier. Axi, you know, comes in 1 milligram doses. We've done all kinds of creative dosing. at a therapeutic with all of those. So those, I think, are the nuances, but those are secondary to efficacy. I think the efficacy with Len-Pembro is really compelling. And again, treat for efficacy and then manage for tolerability, quality of life, and tox.
Anything from your before we call it a day?
I think it's just like we talked about, you know, a decade ago, it's more about learning the drug, how to give it, when to hold, the nuances of dosing and titration. You know, that understanding a drug, or in this case, a regimen, is the most important thing. So pick your favorite and figure out how to give it.
I know you say that, and I'm just going to push back. I don't think in oncology we have the luxury of getting comfortable, because it's going to change. Like, for all we know, it's going to be belzutifan, you know, avelumab in the future. And I think being able to learn new drugs is part of our core skill set. So, you know, I love Acupembra. I'm comfortable with it. If you're going to tell me to pick my favorite, that's my favorite. But boy, the Len-Pembro data is compelling. I'm going to use it next chance I get because of the data. So
that's fine. But you also see a ton of kidney cancer, right? If you're seeing 4 or 5 patients a year, you probably shouldn't give 4 or 5 different regimens, I guess is my point.
I guess.
Right.
I don't know. If the data right, changes.
This sounds like a slightly different debate.
It is.
Excited about. But we might have to do that another. I think my take on this issue, for what it's worth, is I do genuinely think the way we give these drugs and the support structure the patients have while they have them is probably more important than the regime that we give. I do take Betsy's point where, you know, with new drug development, you want to try the latest. But Brian, you know, that community, it looks like my biggest concern at the moment is that I think that we're seeing quite a lot of patients stopping drugs very early, irrespective of the regime we choose, because of toxicity management. And I'd like to address that issue first before we talk about, you know, the subtle differences between these regimes. We've not talked about Ipi-Nivo. The Ipi-Nivo question is actually for a different day, because the profile is very different. But we're going to perhaps do that another time. How does that sound?
Yeah, sounds good. Good discussion. Thanks,
yeah.
Betsy. Appreciate it.
It's great to hear from you.
Thank you both.
See you soon.
All right, bye-bye.